Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In the darkest days of the Great Depression in Canton, Ohio, cheer was hard to find. Then an ad appeared in the local newspaper offering to help 75 unfortunate families. All anyone had to do was write to that address and tell his story, and hundreds of letters were sent to the anonymous benefactor. For more than 70 years, that person's identity was a secret. In his new book, A Secret Gift, author and journalist Ted Gupp tells the story behind his grandfather's generosity and in the process fleshes out the history of the Great Depression. Ted has joined us today to talk about his new book. Welcome to the show, Ted.
Thank you, Ann.
You are an author of two other books and also award-winning investigative journalist, former award-winning investigative journalist for the Washington Post. And I'm wondering, as you went about investigating the story behind this, how was it different for you?
Well, this came to light because my mother handed me a suitcase that belonged to her mother. She didn't know what was in it. And when I opened it, I found hundreds of letters from December 33 and 150 canceled checks. And I had no idea what I was looking at because I didn't know anything about the story. I finally pieced it together and realized this anonymous donor from 75 years ago was my grandfather, and these letters were appeals to him, which he answered with checks for $5, about $80 to $100 in today's value. When I first saw the material and read the letters, I didn't see it as a story. I saw it as a family matter and something relating to my hometown. And it took me months to put on my reporter author's cap and see it for what it was, an extraordinary tale.
You took the opportunity in the process of writing this to also tell the story of the Depression.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of us think we know what the Depression was about. I certainly did. I'd seen the famous photographs, and I'd seen the pictures of the bread lines, and I'd heard the music, Brother, Can You Spare a Dime, that sort of thing. But when I sank into the letters, I realized I didn't know anything about the Depression, that it was something of a magnitude, I think, largely unimaginable to Americans today.
There were lots of photographs, but these felt like the stories behind the photographs.
Yeah, you know, when I first read the letters, I felt I was peeking through a keyhole into the family lives of that era. These folks were opening up their hearts and were as candid as human beings can be in pouring out their discouragement, their disillusionment, also sometimes their hope and certainly their grit. And by the way, my grandfather had promised that their names would never
right.
be known. I only wrote and printed letters in my book where I had releases from family descendants.
That anonymity, not only his anonymous role in this, but promising them anonymity, that their names would never be released, that really opened them up because in that day and age, admitting need and asking for help was very different than it is today.
Yeah, I think that's one of the great revelations to me from the research and from the book is that we think of Americans as being Americans, but in fact, the Americans of that December 1933 were very different from Americans today. There was such pride and such disdain for accepting charity that many of the people who wrote to my grandfather said that they would sooner starve than extend a hand in search of help, and they meant it. And in fact, some of their children came to resent the parents because they were so reluctant to reach out and accept help in those rare instances where it was even offered.
And some of those children are the ones who wrote
yes,
to you.
They were indeed, yeah.
614-292-8513, if you'd like to give us a call and talk to our guest this hour, Ted Gupp. He has written a new book. It is called A Secret Gift, How One Man's Kindness and a Trove of Letters Revealed the Hidden History of the Great Depression. Ted Gupp also is the author of best-selling The Book of Honor and Nation of Secrets. He's an award-winning journalist from the Washington Post, and he now is chair of the Emerson College Journalism Department. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Eventually, You figured out that the letters were from the folks to whom your grandfather had sent the money. He didn't save all the letters, though. You've deduced or figured out that he saved the letters that he responded to.
Right. We don't know how many people wrote to him. It's probable that there were many, many hundreds, maybe even thousands more. I mean, the offer was so electrifying in the community that the local paper, the Repository, wrote a front-page story about it, and word of the offer spread hundreds of miles away and appeared in other papers. I think the reason he didn't keep any of the letters whose writers he did not help is that it would have been just a burden on him to hear their voices and know that that he didn't and couldn't help them.
You know, later on in the story, you make reference to the dance marathons. And that's an image that's always stuck with me from that movie, They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
Yes.
It was one of those aha moments for me as a teenager, you know, watching that movie, realizing how desperate people were. And I was wondering, what in your – you note that desperation was part of it, but he also – there were other things that you think – you don't know, but you think moved him to respond to certain letter writers.
Well, I think a lot of these letters resonated with him. He had a very tough upbringing. He worked in a coal mine for a time. He washed soda bottles with acid until it ate at his fingertips. He was duped into being a strike breaker and was bloodied. So I think that the lives of the people writing in mirrored his own, and I think that was certainly a part of it.
Different things. He had, now the other side of this story, another part of it, another dimension, again, that you didn't expect, was his past was revealed in a way.
Yeah, that actually was a bit shocking to me. I had his birth certificate from Pittsburgh. I had his passports showing the year he was born in Pittsburgh. But as I dug deeper in the course of pursuing the story, I discovered all the documents were fraudulent. I found his name in a passenger list entering the country at age 15 in 1902. He was a refugee from pogroms and persecution in Romania, and I'm sure that the citizens of Canton would have been shocked to learn that the secret Santa who had helped them had in fact been born an Orthodox Jew, spoke Yiddish, and kept kosher. That, I'm sure, was not what they were imagining.
One of you said that you'll never know exactly why he did this, why he kept his life a secret the way he did. But you do mention that at that time in the world, there was a lot, not only the anti-Semitism, but anti-immigration and anti-immigrants.
Right.
A lot of, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, he was really, in terms of the pecking order, to mix metaphors, he was at the bottom of the barrel. Not only was there hostility towards immigrants and some anti-Semitism on the rise, but even among the Jews, the least welcome were the Romanians. They were perceived, rightly or wrongly, as being less literate, less cultured. And in fact, the President of the United States at the time, Theodore Roosevelt, and the Secretary of State, Hayes, at the time, protested Romania's treatment of the Jews, much less because they were concerned for humanitarian reasons than out of fear that they would be coming here, and said as much, said that these people would become a load on America for decades to come. So I think that's why when he got off the ship, he reinvented himself, eventually taking a new name, shedding his Romanian identity, never spoke Yiddish again once he was off the gangplank, stopped keeping kosher, and virtually reinvented himself.
He had a rough road in Pittsburgh, where they first sort of wound up with his family, with his father and his siblings. Tell us about that. His father was a really tough person.
Yeah, his father was not what we like to call today a touchy-feely kind of guy. He had a cigar factory in his home, a tenement, and all of the children were impressed into labor. They had to roll cigars from the earliest age. My grandfather, being the oldest son, was 15, and he wanted to go to school desperately. But my grandfather hid his shoes so he could not go to school. A relative of his tells me that sometimes, even without shoes, he went to school. But the truth is, he really did not get a formal education after the second grade. He could not write cursively. And the beautiful penmanship on the checks that went out in December 33 reflected the education of his wife, my grandmother, and not my grandfather.
Now, she knew all about this, right?
Well, she knew all about the gift because she participated mm-hmm. in it. What she knew about his origins, we don't know. We know, for example, that she knew something was amiss because shortly after his death in 81, I asked questions about him, and she made me promise that as long as she was alive, I would never ask another question. I gave her my word. I kept my word. So she clearly knew that something was wrong.
One of the things I love about the story is how it paints a picture of Canton, Ohio. You go back and you talk about where these people came from, where they lived, maybe what company they owned before they went under because of the crash.
You know, it's funny. I think we all, if we're lucky, we have a place we call a hometown, and mm-hmm. Canton will forever be my hometown, and I have just profound affection for it. And I thought I knew it. I'm a fourth-generation Cantonian. But each time I returned to report on the story, I was accompanied by an ever larger crowd of ghosts, the voices of the people that I was researching. And I came to see the city very differently, and I came to understand much more kind of its character, its determination, its feistiness, its grit. This all was expressed in the letters and passed down generation to generation.
So the recipients, there was the way he worded that letter, the ad, a lot of people called it an ad in the paper, was it was directed at men, which it's not particularly surprising. They were the heads of the families usually and the main breadwinners. But there was something about it that was directed, too, at maybe people that had once been of means.
Right. He directed it to the white-collar man.
That's right.
And I think he identified with that. 4 years earlier, he was bankrupt. That was in 29. He nearly lost everything he had. And by the way, he would be in bankruptcy court again in 37 with the second wave of the Great Depression. So he targeted it, in a sense, towards people in a position like himself. But I think there was absolutely no reluctance once he got the letters to adjust his sights because many, many of the people who received his largesse were women and children. So he was not wedded to that original vision of the white-collar man.
We have to take a break. My guest is Ted Gupp. He's author of a new book. It's called A Secret Gift, How One Man's Kindness and a Trove of Letters Revealed the Hidden History of the Great Depression. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I'm Neil Conan. While you're sorting through your Halloween candy, keep one ear on Talk of the Nation. We'll tell you about who's voting in this election, ballot initiatives around the country. We'll have a marathon political junkie on Wednesday, plus Movies with Murray has campaign brain, too. What's your favorite political movie? Send us an email, talk@npr.org. That's all in the week ahead on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins this afternoon at 2 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. It's 42 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20 this morning. Sunshine today, a high right around 51. Clear skies tonight and a low of 30 degrees.
Support for WOSU comes from Global Gallery, a nonprofit featuring fair trade coffee and handcrafts from around the world in the Short North at Easton and in Clintonville Commons on North High Street. Information at globalgalleryonline.org.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Once I built a railroad, I made it run. Made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Of course, the song Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? For lyrics by Yip Harburg and music by Jay Gorney, and of course, sung by the great Bing Crosby. Joining us now, along with Ted Gupp, is his mother, Virginia Sharp. She first introduced him to the suitcase filled with the old letters. Welcome to the show, Mrs. Sharp.
Thank you.
When did it occur to you to give Ted the suitcase, and why Ted?
Well, first of all, Ted is very interested in anything family and anything old, and he was here to surprise me for my 80th birthday. And we were sitting in my office talking, and I remembered the suitcase, and I said, I have an old suitcase in the storeroom. I don't know what's in it. Would you like to see it? And he said yes. And I brought the suitcase in. It's not a big suitcase. It wasn't. And I gave it to Ted. And he looked in the suitcase, and it was filled with papers. And he asked if he could take it back to his cabin in northern Maine. And I said, certainly. And he did so. And
why did you keep the suitcase for so long?
I frankly don't know. I have many things. I moved here 10 years ago from Florida. I still have 3 cartons that are not unpacked. I think I really don't need those things.
You're
but
right.
I did have a suitcase.
And if I may say, sure. And I apologize for interrupting my mother, but the truth is that we come from a family of pack rats.
Yes, we do.
Well, you're in good company then. Ted, in... what happened, I guess, Mrs. Sharp, when Ted decided, he told you not only what the letters were, but I guess it wasn't, you knew but what the letters were about long before you knew more about your father.
I didn't know the letters existed.
Mm-hmm.
I vaguely remember something with Beaver Dot because we had a boat named that. And it brought back recollections. But I had no idea about the letters. And as I said, I had not looked in the suitcase. And Ted, you know, Ted can discover anything. And I knew he was the one to have the letters, and I'm certainly glad that he received them.
I guess we ought to say Beaver Dot was the name, the moniker that Sam Stone, your grandfather, Ted, yes, gave himself. Tell us about where that name came from.
Well, that's... he had 3 daughters, Barbara, Virginia, Dorothy. My youngest sister, Barbara, is deceased. Dorothy and I are still alive. And that was the name of the boat that we had at Turkey Foot Lake. And that was the name of the secret fund. And no one associated, well, of course, the boat was a Turkey Foot, and it was much later, and people didn't remember and never associated the name.
They didn't, but Ted in the book, Ted mentions in the book that he kind of grew up with this legend about this fellow who gave away $5 to people. It must have been much fresher for you.
Well, it was much more for me, the Beaver Dot part. It was not Beaver Dot, but the letters that my father sent in overcoats that he sent to England.
This is
another story. Yeah, tell us about that.
Go ahead.
Well, it's just that during the war, he wanted people to know that the support of our country and the bravery of the English people, and he was wishing them good luck and keep their spirits up, and sent the overcoats with the letters in the pockets. And that, to me, was always a very dramatic story, and I love to recall it. The other I vaguely remember, I was very, very young, and mm-hmm. frankly, the Depression didn't mean that much to me. I was fortunate in that respect.
Ted, you wrote about how you'd heard stories about this person handing out the money.
Yeah, you know, it was the vaguest mm-hmm. kind of awareness on the periphery of my consciousness. It was not something that I could have really articulated. I probably, as a child, overheard something, but I knew nothing. And in fact, when I encountered the letters in the suitcase, I had no idea what I was looking at. I read a few of them. I put them away for several days because they were addressed to someone whose name meant nothing to me, Beaver Dot, and I had no idea what it was, so I just put it away, and it was only later when I came back to it and I found the yellowing front-page story from the Canton Repository that laid out the terms of this gift and its impact. That's when I put two and two together, realized that it was my grandfather who was the donor, realized that these letters were the appeals to him.
I noticed that when you wrote about it for the New York Times, the story ran, I think, December 22nd or 23rd of 2008.
Yes, and it was it reminded me or told me how important and what potency this gift had. It was on that day, it was the second most emailed story in the New York Times, and it was reprinted in China, in Saudi Arabia. I received emails from South America, from Israel, it was extraordinary, mm-hmm. and it was sort of an antidote to the to the toxic spending and over-the-top living that people were sick of. I mean, it came out not long after the Bernie Madoff scandal.
Mm-hmm.
And people were starved for an example of someone who did something kind and without seeking anything for their own reward.
My guest is Ted Gupp, author and Emerson College journalism professor. He has just written Secret Gift, How a Man's Kindness and a Trove of Letters Revealed the Hidden History of the Great Depression. Also with us, Virginia Stone Gupp Sharp, Ted's mother. What did you think when Ted told you about your father's secret past?
I was very surprised. I did not know. I thought my father was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I knew that he was very poor. I knew that he was self-educated, but I had no idea that he was not born in the United States. And I knew that there was a lot of friction within his family and our family, and rightly so. And I wasn't very close to my father's family. I adored my father. I miss him every day.
But you knew there was friction, but you really didn't understand what it was about?
I didn't understand the depth of it, no.
And Ted, how did you decide to pursue that angle as well?
Well, it seemed to me that it would be hard to write a book about the secret gift without understanding why he made the gift. And to understand why he made the gift, I needed to know more about who he was. I knew him well, or at least I thought I knew him well. As it turns out, I didn't know him nearly as well as I thought I did. But doing this kind of investigative research into his past brought to light a whole other aspect of the man, and I think it shed considerable light on the gift, because I think reaching out to his townspeople on a Gentile holiday and wishing them participation in the Christmas spirit, I think in part it was a way of him thanking the country and the community for taking him in, for providing him a home, for ending a life that before that had been rootless, and I think to some degree gave him a feeling of being unwanted, and that was certainly not the case in Canton.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org if you'd like to join the conversation. We're talking about the book, A Secret Gift, How One Man's Kindness and a Trove of Letters Revealed the Hidden History of the Great Depression. It was interesting to me how you would pick up on some clues from the letters that people wrote and why you think your grandfather might have responded to them, people who, and a lot of it had to do with what they said they would do with the money. Now, this is only $5. You make the point that it's equivalent to about $80 to $100 now. And you know, the price of things were minuscule compared to now, but it was amazing how many people just wanted a pair of shoes.
Yeah, the shoes, if there is one thing that is emblematic of the Great Depression, it's shoes, because without shoes, the children couldn't go to school. The adults couldn't walk the streets looking for work. These letters were written in December. It's very cold in Canton in December. One of the people that wrote to him, the first thing she did when she got the check, and she was 14 years old, was she got a pair of shoes, because her shoes had so many holes in them that she had taken a box of shredded wheat and cut out the shape of her sole from the cardboard box and put it under her feet to try to keep the damp and the cold out. So over and over and over again, I read about the need for shoes.
Another issue were people that maybe were, as you mentioned earlier, struggling with their parents and their the parents' inability to ask for help, accept help, that sort of thing. Again, maybe a little bit of an echo from your grandfather's past and the struggles.
I think that's probable, yes.
You I guess you mentioned earlier, you know, obviously your grandfather was Jewish and nearly all the recipients were not. Do you think that was contrived in any way, or it just happened to be more people asked for help who weren't Jewish?
Let me ask my mother if she has an insight into that.
I don't. It's a very good question. I'm going to think about that for some time.
Here's what I think. I think that that he wanted to thank the Gentile community for making him such a part of the community. And to be honest with you, even though he was born speaking Yiddish and kept kosher, by the time 33 rolled around, he was a classically secularized American Jew who prided himself in having one of the larger Christmas trees on the block and who insisted, even though he had three young children, that he open his presents first. So Christmas was a big deal.
He liked Christmas.
He loved Christmas. You know, that's the dirty little secret of this gentleman. He loved Christmas, and I think he delighted in sharing his good fortune with others that Christmas of 33.
He originally was going to give everybody a little bit more than $5. He changed his mind then.
Yeah, he was going to give $10 to I think it was going to be 75 families. I think what happened was he was so inundated with worthy appeals that he decided to double the number of gifts and have the amount. And I frankly, part of the power of his gift was not just in the monetary value, but in the message it sent, the gesture.
Yeah.
And indeed, even hundreds and probably thousands of people who received nothing from him received some ray of hope in those dark days. Many of the people that wrote to him said, whether you fund me or not, I can't thank you enough for showing that someone cares. And there were people who were contemplating suicide who wrote him letters saying, until I received your letter, I was thinking things that no man should think.
Virginia, when you looked over the letters or learned about some of the people that your father helped back then, did you recognize many of the names?
A few.
Mm-hmm.
Not many. Not many. I have spoken to many of the people that are coming to Canton, and what a wonderful, wonderful group of people. And it's very interesting, as Ted says in the book, what's happened to so many of them, of the descendants of the people who wrote the letters. I've been sort of in awe ever since Ted decided to write this book, and not because he's my son.
That's just a 24/7 kind of a deal, isn't it?
But
well, you know, and the power of this has nothing to do with me. The power has to do with the words and the lives of the people that I'm writing about. And if my book is successful, it's because I was smart enough to get out of the way of their stories. You read these letters, and one of the things you discover is that the art of letter writing is dead. I mean, a lot of these letters were written by people with little or no formal education.
Right.
But you cannot approach their eloquence today.
Do you have a favorite one?
Do I have a favorite one?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a favorite one. There are a couple that move me greatly. There's one by a woman named Edith May. And I just want, if I can find it real quickly, I will read you the part that particularly touched me. This is a woman who was black, Jamaican, and was suffering from the cold. She lived on a farm outside of town. One of the things that's extraordinary about the letter is how it ends. She says, and oh my, I know what it is to be hungry and cold. We suffered so last winter, and this one is worse. Please do help me. My husband don't know I am writing, and I haven't even a stamp, but I am going to beg the mailman to post this for me. Now, that is gripping, and obviously the postman delivered it without a stamp because it's in the suitcase.
Well, do the letters come in envelopes?
There are no envelopes accompanying the letters.
Okay. We have to say goodbye to Virginia Stonegup Sharp, Ted's mother. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Goodbye.
And a little while later, we will be meeting Rebecca Kanoyer.
Yes.
The granddaughter of one of the letter writers. Ted, obviously, you didn't write about every single letter or every single letter writer. You did 500 interviews for this book, I think, something like 500 interviews.
At least.
How did you decide what sort of balance to bring to it? Because not every story was a happy story.
No. And in fact, in the book, you'll see, as you know, not all of them have happy endings. But I wanted it to reflect the community, because really what I was looking at was a chorus that collectively was the entire community. So I wanted it to be represented. representative. It was men and women and children, ranged in age from 78 to 12 years of age. It was black and white. It was native-born and foreign-born. It was some who were captains of industry and fell low and lost everything. It was people who had been coal miners and had very little to begin with. So I wanted to reflect the universe of that community, which was reflected in the letters, and I tried to comb out some of the potential for repetition letter to letter.
And, you know, at the time, correct me if I'm wrong, there was something like a million fewer people out of work then than there are now.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the amazing things is that today we think of the Great Recession being over, and I put that in quotes,
right.
But there's still 15 million people out of work in America, which is about the number that was out of work in the Great Depression. The difference is that today that constitutes about just under 10%, and back in 1933 it constituted about 25% of the population.
And in Canton it was 50% they had.
In Canton the estimate is as high as 50%, maybe even higher. They didn't know, and there was no reason really to try to find out because there was no cavalry riding to the rescue. You know, there just wasn't help on the horizon.
Right.
But the fact is it was a factory town, and the factories weren't producing, and the shifts were being canceled, and the lights were turned out, and every street had people struggling to survive.
We're going to have to take another break, and when we return, we will welcome to the show Rebecca Knoyer. She is the descendant of one of the letter writers. We'll hear about that story. That's a wonderful story. It's one of the happy stories. And if you have a question or comment, like to join the conversation, you're always welcome. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
My wife and I love all the programs along the lines of Car Talk and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. A lot of times, especially say when I'm driving home, I'll be listening to some interesting story and I really want to tell her about it. And inevitably, I know that, you know, she's been listening at home, so it takes our conversations to a different level, I guess. My name is Sid Samsi, and WOSU is my source for local news, information, and entertainment for my whole family.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here. Ohio's mental health system was once a national model. We'll hear about the budget crisis facing mental health services with Columbus Dispatch reporters Alan Johnson and Catherine Kandisky. That discussion begins at 11 on WOSU 820 NPR News. And it's 43 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunny skies today, a high of 51 degrees. Clear skies tonight and a low right around 30 degrees. Sunny for Tuesday and a high of 51. Mostly clear Tuesday night and a low of 32. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
I walk along the street of sorrow, the boulevard of broken dreams, where gigolo and gigolette can take a kiss without regret, though they forget their broken dreams. You laugh tonight and cry tomorrow when you behold your shattered dreams. And gigolo and gigolette wake up to find their eyes are wet.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. That is called Boulevard of Broken Dreams, lyrics by Al Dubin, music by Harry Warren. It was sung by Deanne Janis with Hal Kemp's orchestra. Joining us now, Rebecca Knoyer. Her grandmother, Rachel DeHoff, was one of the letter writers. And welcome to the show, Rebecca.
Thank you, Ann.
You were born and raised in Canton. Did you ever hear about this story before?
I heard bits and pieces of it. I had no idea the extent to which my dad and my uncle and my grandmother really kind of suffered through the Depression, how hard it was on them. They didn't really talk about that much. But I certainly knew that my grandmother was a widower and my dad had lost his father at a relatively young age.
She was one of the women who said, I know you asked for men to write, but I don't care. I need help, too. She was quite a lady.
She was. In rereading this, I picked up the book on Thursday, and I was rereading everything, and I had to laugh at some of the things because she was. She was a very tough, determined woman. And when Ted had written something about, you know, she was hell-bent on providing for her family. Hell-bent is pretty much a good term to use for my grandmother.
Do you have the letter with you?
I do.
Would you mind reading it?
No, it'd be fine. Dear Mr. B. Verdot, I saw in last night's paper the most human thing I have ever seen in print before. Instead of giving to some church or organization to have your name mentioned over the pulpit or in the newspaper, you have chose the silent way of celebrating Christ's birth, which you surely will be repaid. No wonder prosperity has returned to you and yours. May it never look dark again for you is my prayer. Well, I will write a few things about my circumstances. You mentioned men, but I am not a man, but I am taking the responsibility of a man as a father and mother. My husband died 2 years ago this March, left me with two boys to support, one in McKinley High, another 9 years old. I have worked every day at real estate, and you know what an uphill job that has been, but I have been able to keep my home and boys with food and clothing by the effort I have put forth. It looks pretty dark sometimes, but we still hold on to that ray of hope that this terrible depression will soon be over. And I want to state that I have never received charity of any kind or have never complained to anyone before. But after I read your letter, I made up my mind to write to you, not asking, just telling you my circumstances. But if you think I am deserving of part of your Christmas cheer that you are giving, I assure you it will be greatly appreciated and spent for the right kind of things for my boys and myself. May God bless you, and wishing you a Merry Christmas and prosperous New Year. I remain Mrs. R. Dehoff.
She sort of brought together so many of the elements, Ted, that you talked about in your book.
Yeah, the grit, the pride, the independence, the determination. She really does bring it all together. I have to say it was a pleasure hearing it read in the words of one of her descendants. I mean, that's very nice, Rebecca. That's very nice.
Rebecca, what did you think when Ted contacted you?
I didn't know what to think. I was a little suspicious, Ted. I
understand.
A flim-flam man.
I have an old college beau that works for the repository, and I actually called him and said, you know, what's up with this guy? So, and he assured me that you were on the up and up. So,
how far you grew up? Both of you grew up in Canton, same neighborhood, far away from each other.
I grew up. I went to Perry High School, so I grew up actually in the suburbs. I didn't live in Canton proper.
Okay. And Ted, did you grow up in Canton proper?
In Canton proper, okay. 22nd Street Northeast. Yep.
So when Ted told you about this story, you grew up remembering your grandma, right?
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I spent many summers with her. She would take care of me during the summers, and I could go down to the city playground.
She was a very busy lady. Tell us about her. She was pretty special.
She was amazingly special in that she had a very robust career in real estate, and she just was always on the go. She, you know, worked very, very hard, but she also made sure that she took vacations, and I remember her going to Cuba when you could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember her going to Arizona and wintering in Arizona towards the latter part of her life. So she was very busy, very hard worker.
And one of the things, if I may say, one of the things that I find very comforting is that in some of these cases, not all regretfully, but in some of these cases, I'd say even many, the people who were really in the trough of the Great Depression worked their way out of it, and in later years enjoyed a quality of life that I think was unimaginable to them in that Christmas of 33. And I think that Rachel Dehoff is one of those individuals.
Right. She came from a mining town.
Yes.
Where is it? Was that in West Virginia or?
No, it was in it's in
Ohio?
Canton.
Okay.
Or I'm south of Canton. It's in Ohio. But it was very, very poor. She came from very, very poor background.
And she was widowed young, and then never remarried?
Never remarried.
You are going to join Ted and his mother and other people in Canton this weekend. Tell us about what's going to happen.
Well, Ted probably knows more than I do about that. But, yeah, my sister and I are going to be flying in. My sister's coming. We're going to go USAR, so, you know, you always have to kind of meet in Charlotte. So she and I are actually meeting in Charlotte. She's coming from North Carolina, and then we're flying into Canton for it. So it'll be a big reunion for us as well.
Ted, tell us what's going to happen.
Well, it's an event that starts at 5 o'clock on Friday evening at the Palace Theater, which was built in 1926, and where many of the letter writers went to escape the Great Depression with a nickel matinee performance. But on this night, the mayor will be there and will introduce me. I'll tell the story of Beaver Dot, and then I will be bringing a number of the descendants on stage to read the letters that their parents wrote, talk a little bit about what became of them and the families. There is a composer, a well-respected composer, who's written a suite of music around the letters and the story, and he and six musicians are flying in to perform a suite of music around these letters. And then there'll be a special guest at the event, the one living letter writer, the only person who wrote to Beaver Dot in 33 who's still alive, and she will be there and read her letter and tell her story.
That is Helen Palm.
It is.
Can you tell us a little bit about Helen?
Well, the funny thing is that after interviewing 500 people, there was only one letter for whom I could not find descendants. I'd given up, turned the book in, it was edited, and I had an afternoon free, and I tried once more to find a descendant of Helen Palm. I talked with her daughter, Janet, and I asked her the questions, you know, when was your mother born? Tell me about when she was married, where she grew up. I was about to ask when she passed, and she interrupted me and said, would you like to speak with her? And I about fell off my chair. And as if that wasn't good enough, Helen actually remembered the offer, the letter, and how she spent the money. The paper in those days was 3 cents. Family couldn't afford it, so they went to a neighbor's to read it, and that's where Helen saw the ad. And she didn't tell her dad because her dad would not have accepted charity. You know, Helen, to this day, and she was 14 when she wrote the letter. She's in her 90s now. She's a spitfire. I'm telling you, she is remarkable. Her memory is terrific, and she really does embody a lot of the spine of that era.
How many people wrote thank you notes?
I don't know the definitive number, but there were certainly, I would say, dozens who wrote thank you notes, at least that were saved. It doesn't mean that that was the total. And the other thing that appears to be the case is that what went out with the check was a note from my grandfather, and we have none of those.
Okay. So you don't know what he said?
I have no idea. But there is reference in the thank you notes and a few of the thank you notes to his kind words. So it wasn't just a check.
He wrote another thing I was surprised at in just reading your book, and maybe this was these are exceptions, but how quickly he responded.
Yeah. Well, you know, the mails were remarkable in those days. The ad ran on the 18th, and some of the thank you notes were dated the 20th.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the checks arrived in some cases the 19th or the 20th. It's a small town, but even so, I doubt that the mail would be delivered that quickly today. It was extraordinary.
Rebecca, have you read the book?
I'm not quite done with it. I picked it up on Thursday, and I've been reading it. It's a wonderful book.
What does it tell you?
You know, what surprised me a lot, I didn't realize all the history
of
Canton.
Yeah,
I did not realize that. And so that's what I was very interested learning about. I think that it's going to be I can't wait till I finish it. I'm going to have my husband read it because he really enjoys history, and I'm going to have my son, who's 15, read it. It will be his only connection, really, to Canton and to his grandmother.
Yes, I said earlier, it's like a little bit of a roadmap of Canton.
And actually, one of Rachel Dehoff's sons,
that's right,
Judge Dehoff, was instrumental in cleaning up Canton. Canton had a certain notoriety around the number of brothels that it had.
That's right.
And
just
Judge
organized crime in general.
Yeah, and organized crime. It was known as Little Chicago, and the New York Times wrote about it in that light. The city editor in 26 was gunned down in his driveway after writing about the connection between the mob and the police. But Judge Dehoff, as a prosecutor, helped close a lot of those brothels, and it did change the character of the community.
614-292-8513. We have a few more minutes left with Ted Gupp. He's the author of A Secret Gift, How One Man's Kindness and a Trove of Letters Revealed the Hidden History of the Great Depression. Also joining us, Rebecca Knoyer. Her grandmother was one of those letter writers requesting help from Ted Gupp. But as I mentioned earlier, Ted, it's still amazing to me how many people, and there must have been many, many more, who said, even if you don't send me anything, you sent me that bit of cheer. And you do draw the parallels between then and now.
Yeah, there was a graciousness about these individuals, even when they had nothing. And there was no presumptuousness. I mean, one of the words that's come into our vocabulary now is entitlement. But there was no sense of entitlement on their part. And in fact, no matter how low and down and out they were aware that others had it worse, and many, many of the letters referred to the fact that they would fully understand if their appeal was not answered because they knew of so many that were suffering even worse.
What did you learn from the Great Depression from doing this?
Well, I mean, one of the things I learned, I think, is that this was the origin of the greatest generation. I think it helps explain why the generation that went off to war in World War II was of the nature that they were, why they were so resourceful, self-sacrificing, collaborative. I think that their characters were forged in this period. And I think I also came to understand something about the American character that I didn't understand before, that our willingness to accept assistance and help from the government in the form of the New Deal and such was a direct result of very industrious and very proud people having to come to terms with the limits of their own resourcefulness, that no matter how industrious and hardworking and determined these folks were, there was a systemic failure so grave that they couldn't prevail. And unless someone came to the rescue, they were going to disappear. And that was something of a revelation to me.
If you could go back and ask your grandfather one question about his act of kindness, what would it be?
Well, I think it might be, why the heck didn't you tell me about it? I think, you know, we had a lot of pretty good heart-to-hearts, and I would have loved to have known, and he never did share that with me, and that's something I would have liked to have known.
Rebecca, by the way, if you want to see a photo of the letter that Rebecca read, you can go to All Sides with Ann Fisher on Facebook and see a photo of it and a video about it. Rebecca, the first time you read it, how did it make you feel?
Well, the first thing I thought of was it was pretty darn well written for somebody with a fourth grade education.
Yeah.
I was surprised, you know, struggling with my, you know, my son's in school now and seeing how the kids write and everything. I thought, wow, you know, for fourth grade, that was amazing. But what I was most struck by was in fact the way she said, I'm not asking, I'm just telling you my circumstances, and I would be very appreciative, you know, if you were to recognize them, but, you know, I just want you to be aware of my circumstances.
Ted, when did you get the idea to bring everybody together?
I think that idea occurred to me about the time that I was about halfway through the reporting. I thought that a lot of these people had a lot in common. They shared a tradition and pride in what their forebears had gone through, and I wanted to thank them. I mean, all these people, like Rebecca, trusted me with stories about their families. They didn't have to do that. You know, no one got paid. No one, you know, they just, you know, trusted me with some very, sometimes very heartfelt stories about what their families had endured. And I just wanted to say thank you. And 60 of the descendants, I'm hosting a banquet on their behalf afterwards in an old German tavern.
Benders?
Right. You know, I'm in these folks' debt. I mean, this book would have been completely and utterly impossible without their help, support, and trust. So that's when it occurred to me how much I was in their debt.
Benders, amazingly, is still there. It was your grandpa's favorite place to hang out for lunch.
Yes. It was founded in 1902, and my grandmother, my grandfather's wife, had her first meal there in 1912. And its presence weaves its way through the narrative of the book.
Well, Ted Gupp, author of A Secret Gift, How One Man's Kindness and a Trove of Letters Revealed the Hidden History of the Great Depression. I stayed up way too late last night reading it. Enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. It's Ted Gupp. Also with us, Rebecca Kanoyer in this segment. Rebecca, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for asking me.
That's all the time we have for All Sides with Ann Fisher. Thanks for joining us to you out there. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.